An exhibit at the Portland Art Museum that runs through early November features the works of six BIPOC photographers following the racial justice protests after the murder of George Floyd in 2020. The narrative at the entrance to the exhibit provides what the photographers offer as a critical lens on 100 days of demonstrations in Portland. Quote, through the growing pains of organizing and sustaining hundreds of direct community action events, the fire in Portland never ceased to burn. The fire that fueled righteous rage and passion in the hearts of those who participated bore witness and were inspired to make change. Well, Mike, let's talk about our first impressions of this fabulous exhibit and then take up some of what such projects carry and their potential to structure public memory of mass protests. The exhibit is aptly titled Perspectives, which brings to mind the famous cultural critic, John Berger, who talked about ways of seeing. Well, what did you see when you entered this exhibit?
I thought it was extraordinary, Jan. What I saw to begin with was the most striking thing was drone photos hovering over Pioneer Square, looking down, very abstract with the terracotta buildings on one side. It's sort of hard to get yourself oriented. But then you realize the square was packed with people. And another drone photo of the Burnside Bridge, just packed with people. And I'd realized the extent to which the sort of raggedy end of the demonstrations had caused me to somewhat undercut my sense of all that had happened. It reminded me that for a while at the beginning, the sight of a white cop looking the camera square in the eye as he choked the life out of George Floyd was such a vivid, compelling moment that validated the Black Lives Matter movement that had started earlier in 2013 with the deaths of Trayvon Martin and Michael Brown. It had just made it clear that, yes, this is supreme indifference to Black life shown here, and that we were galvanized and everybody poured out. But of course, Portland was together, but Portland didn't stay together. And the other pictures there include some extraordinary combat photography of tear gas foaming, of cops decked out in layers of protection, of people engaged, people yelling, the whole range of people presented by these six very different photographers, offering individuals looking you squarely in the eye, people full of hope and passion in the midst of a demonstration, intimate shots, big sweep distance shots, all kinds of photographs and perspectives that reclaimed for me to a large extent what was really a profound series of events.
And it very much earned that title of Perspectives, not in that typical, the conservative anti versus the pro-social justice side, but more within this movement, the different ways of looking at it. And I agree there was something particularly compelling about these almost mosaic abstract images from a distance, drone shots of masses of people where each individual was pretty indistinguishable from the other. And then these very intimate shots with relationships, moods of people, and both celebration and grief and mourning and anger. And when you walk into the exhibit, there's that juxtaposition right at the beginning with this mosaic of people, thousands of people. And then alongside of that is this mural size image of a young, what looks like a young Black man on the top of a car. And he projects a kind of defiance, but also gracefulness and sure-footedness. I really like the choice of that image that is set aside the image of the mass movement, because sometimes mass movements, the individuals involved get lost in the masses.
Yeah, that was a great picture, dancing on an SUV.
Yeah. So there were six photographers that created this sequence of images, including Emery Barnes, Joseph Blake, Linnaeus Boland, God Be, David Jacobo, Mariah Harris, and Byron Merritt. You know, you mentioned the drone shots of crowds and police and clouds of tear gas. That was, I think, by Joseph Blake. But I was surprised there was not much in the photography of the police themselves. They were actually fairly small in the overall picture here. There were some of, like you say, combat positions, but overall it seemed to almost marginalize the police in the whole story that unfolds. Did you have any sense of that?
Oh, I disagree. I think there were plenty of cop shots of people showing a photograph from the side of a row of cops decked out, one intimate shot of all the different things dangling from the cop's chest, all the different methods of repression that were easily at hand. And finally, there was a video there. I don't know if you caught that video of actual tear gas foaming, leaf blowers. It was basically combat, which was successful. I mean, basically, Trump's people were routed militarily from the Justice Building. An extraordinary thing. It would have been great to declare victory and quit, but of course, injustice continued. Racism has not stopped. People went on. But yeah, I thought there was a pretty good coverage of cops in general, cops in a row, a couple of individuals in that video sequence.
Yeah, I liked the focus on, you know, as I was a clinical psychologist and therapist in the past, I've been interested in how people sustain themselves over a long period of time of struggle. And there was one photographer, Linnaeus Bolin Godby, who is an artist and a therapist, who created this series of photographs on art therapy events as places of healing. And of course, that was amidst the pandemic that all this unfolded. And most everyone there was wearing masks. But this part of movements that itself is an important perspective, you know, how you sustain yourselves in an ongoing fight. And some of that sustaining, as you said, was done not very well in the course of that movement. And sometimes as people get more desperate, fewer crowds, things thin out, you can get more chaotic expressions of violence. But here, I think the focus was on the relational side of movements, children coming with their parents, couples, families, as well as people gathering in these places to celebrate and be creative, as well as express anger and outrage.
Well, the range was exceptional in this show. All the things you've described, plus Mariah Harris had a couple of great photographs in color of like the wall of moms during that period, and of one of women looking at the camera with lights holding up, one that has really a great shot of eyes on the brink of tears. Of course, eyes became so important. They're always expressive, and we communicate all kinds of meaning with our eyes. And that truth is really heightened by all the masks that everyone was wearing, because of course this was happening all at the height of COVID. And the photographer's use of masks and reliance on them in some of their pictures was really deft and really meaningful.
There was also a series of photographs where the eyes were clearly blacked out for identity purposes.
That's right.
There are different ethics about journalism and field photography, where in general you do not need to get permission because people are in spaces where they're intending to make a public statement. But then there also are other questions if you're focusing on someone or if they're in a situation that puts them in risk legally, then you have other obligations. So it'd be interesting to know how those discussions unfolded and their responsibilities to the subjects in the photographs.
Well, yeah, there were a couple of exceptional pictures, really large blow-up shots of people like on the move in midair with the black bar over their eyes, thin black bar, so much of their face was revealed.
Yeah.
It was itself almost part of the work was the use of those black bars.
You know, and especially as one of the whitest big cities in this country, Portland did play kind of an outsized role in national protests and has in the past a long history of protests and sustained resistance. So I think it was also conveying a legacy here of activism and resistance. It's important. And of course, particularly in that Portland has a long history of racism, including elected leaders and sheriffs who belong to the Ku Klux Klan and as a kind of sanctuary for white homeland people, for white supremacists in the 80s and 90s. So there's this mix of histories that I think are complicated, but this is part of that history. Speaking of white supremacists and the legacy of white supremacy, what was your take on the fourth floor gallery that includes some reflections on the history of racism in Portland, reflections on the Black Lives Matter movement, and where in a corner you see the Thomas Jefferson statue pulled down from its place in front of Jefferson High School, now occupying a humble corner of the museum under the heading Untitled Work?
Well, it was the whole exhibit, by the way, is a remarkable expression of all the creativity and reality and presence of Black people. I mean, Portland is indeed the whitest city, but that doesn't mean there aren't 35 or 40,000 Black people. There's two Black newspapers published here. They get picked up by somebody. There's a really significant presence here that got highlighted with a good show on the fourth floor. It's very multimedia. There's like a bodega. There's some different forms of expression. And the Jefferson statue, I mean, that's a profound thing.
The statues coming down was part of the Black Lives Matter movement, and statues that represented the legacy and the continued idealization of white supremacists. Thomas Jefferson was caught up in that dismantling of heroes.
Well, you know, Jefferson wrote very articulate writings that have inspired people all over the world, movements for independence, the Declaration of Independence. But he also coasted on the backs of 600 to 700 slaves that he owned, that he did not release like some of the other founding fathers. So he raises the issue in some ways of aristocrats in general. All the writings and all the music, the art, for the most part, was created over the last 1,000 years by people who depended entirely on the works of other people, on the back-breaking efforts of other people. And Jefferson is a perfect paradox. I mean, you can make a picture of him as heroic, but you can also make a picture of him as a sponger, as somebody who fooled himself. He pretended to be what he was not, somebody who masked from himself how much he exploited hundreds, not just a few, but hundreds of people. So those are both real. It's a big paradox that I don't know quite how to sort out, but you cannot deny either side of him.
Yeah. And, you know, Jefferson High School, the historic Black high school in Portland, was named Jefferson for a reason. And perhaps the other side of that legacy was really brought to the fore during the Black Lives Matter movement and pulling down the statue. And it's appropriate to put it in a museum where it's an object of discussion, where you have to look at also the commentary around it and discussion around it, but that it still has a place somewhere.
Exactly. I think that's great. He should not be simply deified and immortalized, quote unquote, by being placed prominently, but neither should he be forgotten. He can't be forgotten. He has already inspired and been quoted by people leading revolutionary movements around the world.
There are a lot of elements to this exhibit on both the second floor and the fourth floor. It's important to take them both in, but it's worth several visits and interesting discussions. So once again, this is Jan Hawken and Mike Snedeker talking today about Perspectives, the exhibit at the Portland Art Museum that runs through early November. Catch it while you can.
Yes, Jen, and I urge people, the Portland Museum deserves kudos for offering the space and time to put this terrific show together, and you should really go see it.